From KCUR News, this is Casey Kearns reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. On this week's show, the second installment of our Suburban School series looks at the Shawnee Mission District.
Our legislative platform is an attempt to make sure that our legislative delegation and patrons are aware of the inherent problems we believe that exist in the school finance formula.
Plus, murder-suicide is rare, but on the rise. A local forensic psychologist speaks about warning signs and potential triggers.
There are about 1,000 to 1,500 of these situations each year in the United States. Almost all of them, over 90%, are committed by males.
And how one small business in the West Plains weathered the recession.
Some days it'll stay like this all day. Some days we have some quiet time. We can get some other things done, like placing orders to restock the shelves.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. This is Casey Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
The news is filled with stories about the successes and struggles of the Kansas City, Missouri School District, but the metro area contains dozens of districts, each with its own story. That's why we've started a series on the challenges of suburban schools. Last week, we looked at Hickman Mills. This week, it's Shawnee Mission.
In recent years, the very conservative Kansas legislature has taken a hardline strategy to cut taxes and limit spending. This frugality and lower state revenue has resulted in less funding for schools. In the past 4 years, the Shawnee Mission School District has seen a budget reduction of $25 million. The district has responded by closing 6 schools since 2007 and laying off 400 staff members since 2009. But things aren't about to get any easier anytime soon. Kansas schools have been receiving some extra money from part of a 1 cent sales tax during the past few years. But that funding will end in June of 2013, and the state's new tax plan will result in a $705 million budget shortfall by the end of 2014.
Of course, Shawnee Mission follows the proceedings in Topeka carefully, and about 8 years ago, the district hired lobbyist Stuart Little to make sure its voice was heard in the Capitol. Stuart Little recently took part in a town hall meeting to explain the district's situation and political interests. Shortly after that, I called Little at his office in Topeka. Now, you recently outlined the district's lobbying plan as part of a district-wide town hall meeting, and I wanted to ask you about some of the things that the district is hoping to get the legislature to do in the next year or so. To start with, the district wants to make it easier for districts to raise money locally. What is currently preventing them from doing that?
Right now, the school finance formula sets the amount of state funding that the state distributes out to school districts, and the state budgets that process and spends that money. As well, the state has a cap on the amount of local effort that communities can contribute to their own school districts. It's called the local option budget. And so the school finance formula includes both state funding and an amount that a school district can raise locally through local property taxes. The dollars that come from the state are finite, and the dollars that can be raised locally are limited as well.
So how would the district like to see that change?
There are two things. And the beginning premise of the Shawnee Mission School District legislative platform, as it has been for a variety of years, is that we are supportive of an evaluation, review, and hopefully revisions to the school finance formula itself, which began in the current formula began in 1992, in part because the formula and the way the funding is distributed from the state, there is a very wide variation around the state in the dollars that are available on a per pupil basis for students. And so the Shawnee Mission School District is in the entire state of Kansas, in the 286 school districts, I think, that currently exist, we're in the bottom 10% on a per-pupil basis. And so the dollars that we get to educate students in Shawnee Mission School District are in the bottom percent of the per-pupil basis around the state. And at the same time, the school district is capped, and this gets to the other part of the issue, is capped in the amount of local revenue that we can raise to try to fill that gap. And so we first and foremost are interested in continuing to have conversations about revising the school finance formula to make that more equitable and fair for the students, patrons, the taxpayers in Shawnee Mission School District. And at the same time, we're very conscious and aware of the reality of the impact of the tax bill, the kind of the constriction on state revenue here for a while, and how the dollars that will be available from the state to bump up that state part of the funding are going to be very limited. The district believes that for the expectations of what patrons want to see, what parents want to have available for their students in the district, requires both efficiency and us being wise stewards of the state and local dollars that we get, but also bumping up that cap on what is a local district can decide that they want to raise. And there's a variety of ways that local revenues can be raised. You don't just have to bump up the local option budget cap, although that's probably the most straightforward way. There are a variety of other things that are possible, avenues that are possible to do that. And so our legislative platform is an attempt to make sure that our legislative delegation and patrons are aware of the inherent problems we believe that exist in the school finance formula, and as well educate them about the need for increased revenue because we are in that funded at that very low per pupil basis, the cuts we've made in the prior years, the expectation of continued high performance from the district suggests that enhancing, opening up, expanding some of those local options to raise revenue that don't cost the state money are what we're going to be working with our legislative delegation about.
I think a lot of people would be surprised to find out that Shawnee Mission District receives less money per pupil than the large majority of districts in Kansas. Why is that?
Well, the formula contains a variety of weightings, and to say it's complex is an understatement. The school finance formula is a lengthy mathematical formula that throws in a variety of weightings and factors, and some of the weightings are dependent upon how many, for example, free and reduced lunch students you have, which at Shawnee Mission is now at about 37%, which is really historically high for the school district. There are weightings whether you are a small school district or not. There are other weightings for the number of English language learners that you have. So there's a variety of components into the school finance formula that then distribute those dollars out across the state. The outcome of that formula puts us in the bottom in the per pupil spending.
The district is also interested in seeing some changes in the way special education is funded by the state. Can you explain that?
The state funds special education by reimbursing, by law, the state is supposed to reimburse school districts for 92% of the actual costs for providing services to special education students. Whether the state reaches that goal at 92%, you know, sometimes they're around the margins. But the reality is the way that the special education formula works is the actual special education costs are not reimbursed at that rate. So there was a legislative post-audit a couple of years ago that concluded that the range, some school districts, there is a school district that's reimbursed in about the 50% of the excess cost range, and another district that was over 200%. And so for a special ed child attending school at Shawnee Mission School District, the costs for that student are reimbursed at 72%, and if you are a special ed student in another school district, the costs are reimbursed at 200%. And so we would like to see, and we believe it's fiscally responsible probably, to bring down that top, bring up the bottom, and get everybody closer to that 92% range, because if we do that, that treats kids equally and fairly around the state and gets us closer to what the law says the state is supposed to be doing.
Now, the district is opposed to allowing tax credits or vouchers, which would support schools that don't have the same requirements as regular public schools. Why is that important?
You know, the Shawnee Mission School District has to serve every single student that walks in the door. And that can be a wide range of costs depending on the students that come in. I think that goes back to our discussion about special education. Some of the needs for a special education child are incredibly expensive, and you know that's a responsibility that the public school system takes on, that Shawnee Mission takes on. And those kinds of requirements should be expected of a private school that would be accepting state funds, or you know, if you do a tax credit, you're not necessarily sending funds directly to a school, but you're taking money out of the state general fund for a tax credit that would otherwise be available to be used in the public school system.
The district is also opposing unfunded mandates or programs. Have there been efforts in the legislature to try to impose those?
Well, I think that the language in the platform is pretty general and unspecific language about unfunded mandates, and this arises from some of the kind of prior year legislative interest in things such as mandating that 65% of the funding be used in the classroom. Shawnee Mission already meets that goal. We expend more than 65% of our funding in classroom on instruction, but other school districts in the state do not necessarily. And those kinds of things, there's been an effort in prior years to mandate centralized uniform accounting procedures and a variety of other things that if the state is going to mandate performance on some of these issues from school districts, that needs to be mindful of the cost that's required for folks to perform those tasks and to make sure that comparable funding is available if that's something the state wants to see done. Because if it's a new responsibility or a new authority placed on the school district to carry that out are X numbers of dollars that won't be available for classroom instruction.
More generally, the district wants to see a sustainable finance formula. What would that look like?
This topic really arose after the Montoy decision, and the legislature for, I think, at least two cycles talked about and put together what were essentially kind of two-year funding cycles, because as you're well aware in the public budgeting process, you're working on the next year's budget halfway through the current year, and with school finance and the way the dollars that come from the state happen, that appropriations process sometimes isn't over until May or June of a calendar year, and school districts have to start their next fiscal year in July of that year. And so if you're making cuts or additions, and it's, you know, more likely cuts, you're making those adjustments late in the legislative cycle, you're pushing up against the budget cycle for the next year. And so districts and, you know, any entity, not a governmental entity, but any entity wants to have predictability and stability and be able to project what happens 2 years out. And so that's a general statement in the platform that urges the legislature to contemplate, as they have done in the past, talking about what's budgeted for 2 years rather than just a one-year cycle to make it easier and more predictable.
You're also supporting the continuation of spring school board elections. Why is that?
School board elections are held in the spring. They are nonpartisan elections. There's no identification of a candidate as a Republican or a Democrat on the ballot. And they are held at that time, and it allows a transition before the next school year begins. There has been a conversation in prior years and legislation last year, I believe, and the year before, that would have moved those school board elections to the fall election cycle. And the belief of the board is that to move school board elections to the fall cycle partisan politicizes the school board elections in a practice that I think is contrary to what folks believe the focus on education and what do as the public believe are the best folks for the school district they want. It's not a partisan issue. It's a real policy issue about what people believe their school district be. So we will continue to maintain our opposition to moving that election to the fall and turning it into a partisan election.
Stuart Little, thank you so much for your time.
All right, thank you.
Stuart Little is the lobbyist for the Shawnee Mission School District.
So heavy.
just ahead, trying to understand the psychology of those who commit murder-suicide. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Murder-suicide is rare, but on the rise across the country. Missouri is in the top 10 for women killed by intimate partners, and murder-suicide has increased in Kansas. When murder-suicide occurs, it leaves loved ones and friends with many unanswered questions. Amid the shock, anger, and grief, people ask themselves why. They wonder, what did we miss, or what could we have done? For answers, we turn to Overland Park forensic psychologist Dan Claiborne. Casey Currents' Susan Wilson started by asking Dan to identify some of the major contributing factors in murder-suicide cases.
Access to guns, previous threats with weapons, whether there's a stepchild in the house turns out to be a factor that statistically shows up, and then whether there's estrangement between the perpetrator and the victim. 92% of these situations involve guns. 74% of the murder-suicides involve the murder of an intimate partner. So almost always it's someone who's intimately involved with the murderer.
I know over the past 2 years in Kansas, there's been an increase in murder-suicides, and actually across the country this has been an issue, and certainly last weekend we had a local example of that. What's the typical profile of someone who commits a murder-suicide?
Well, first of all, you know, we estimate that there are about 1,000 to 1,500 of these situations each year in the United States. Almost all of them, over 90%, are committed by males. So definitely the perpetrator is almost always male. The primary risk factor is whether there's been prior domestic violence. Murder-suicides, you know, can't be predicted because it's such a rare occurrence, really. It's such a low-level frequency occurrence that you can't predict it. But the risk factors, if you look at them that way, the primary one would be any history of domestic violence in the relationship already. 40% of murder-suicides, the individual doing the murder-suicide is a person who's jealous and abusing substances. So that's very common.
You mentioned males, and you were saying that most murder-suicides are perpetrated by males. Why men?
Well, most murders in general are committed by men, about 90%. Men are just more aggressive. And take that as a method of solving problems, aggression rather than communication. We don't really know. It's interesting, the brains of women have a larger area that generates violent or aggressive impulses. But women also, the part of the brain that filters those impulses is also more highly developed in women. So the output of women in terms of violent actions is much lower than that of men. It's kind of interesting that way.
Now, you also mentioned substance abuse as a factor here. How does that play a role in instances of murder-suicide?
The research doesn't really explain how it plays a role, but those of us in violence risk prediction kind of fields think that it's a little bit like a recipe of ingredients. You have the emotional arousal on the part of the person that generates the need to do something. Then you have maybe a situation that allows for something to be done, namely maybe it's you're in private so nobody's watching. Then you have access to a weapon, a means to commit an action. And then you have what we might call a disinhibitor, whether it's drinking or using substances or something like that, to allow the person to overcome their socially trained instincts not to harm someone. So it's like a recipe of ingredients. So we think that the substance use comes in, or alcohol use comes in, as a way of lowering the threshold for the person to do something that normally, without that substance, they might not be able to do it.
You talked about past history of domestic violence, and I guess past behavior is the best predictor of future behavior where violence is concerned. So is it a pattern of domestic violence that is predictive, or is it one or two instances? How would people, families, begin to see these instances as warning signs?
Well, that's a really good question. It has to do with several aspects of the history. First of all, is there a history of domestic violence at all? But more importantly, what's been the frequency of it, and what's been the intensity of it, how serious it's been, and what's been the recency of it? So the more recent it is, the more of a warning sign it is, the more intense it's been, the more physically harmful or destructive it's been, and the more frequent it's been. There's a lot of us think that with a situation where there's been domestic violence, that there's a tendency for the violence to escalate because the what's been done before, it doesn't feel like enough. And so the person needs to make a stronger point the next time. And then the other thing is, once you've crossed a line like being physical or using a weapon or using threats or any of those things, then it's much easier to cross that line next time. And so the tendency is to escalate as time goes on. So that's the way we think it works.
Now, what about financial issues? Are they a catalyst in situations of murder-suicide?
The researchers think that all sorts of extraneous variables can be, whether it's financial pressures, work pressures. But since this is a very low occurrence phenomenon, it's really been hard to show that those are causal factors like the other things. One interesting thing that's come out of the research is that the average age discrepancy between the person doing the murder and the victim is 6 years. The murderer is 6 years older than the victim.
I wonder why that might be.
Well, I don't know. Men tend to have relationships with women who are somewhat younger anyway, so it may just be an artifact. But it's the average difference has been noted to be 6 years.
Now, as we think about personality factors here, because I know you mentioned a lot of statistical factors, but is there a certain type of personality, maybe type A or maybe a personality that tends to be very controlling, that would place someone at higher risk for being a perpetrator of murder-suicide?
Well, I think we have to really, in a way, separate out the murder part from the suicide part. And I'm not speaking here from a research base because I don't know that this has been studied that much. But yes, I think there are certain factors that influence a person to be willing to take the step of murdering someone. And I think that has to do with a person who is highly emotional, who is impulsive. Yeah, most people who commit murder are young, so they're more of an age that where people are impulsive and they do things quickly. Probably, in many cases, this is me speaking as a person who's more of a therapist than a researcher, probably it's more common with people who are highly self-centered, who have been used to being in control of themselves and other people, and also have a very strong need to protect their image. And so if they feel that someone has betrayed them or been disloyal to them, they are going to be likely to be much more intolerant of that or upset with that or unable to cope with that than somebody who didn't have such a sense of pride or such a sense of self-importance. Then the suicide part, it probably is related to similar things. If a person is very self-centered and has a lot of pride and a lot of concern about their image, once they've committed some horrible act, they may be a lot less able to imagine a life after that in which they make amends, are accepted again by the community, are able to recover, overcome this, and do anything healthy and productive. They may not be able to imagine that happening. It may be a bigger blow to their ego to imagine the disapproval and the condemnation of others after this event has happened. And so those factors might propel them to have to remove themselves from the situation rather than to face consequences. We also know that suicide is usually a very impulsive act. For example, people who kill themselves with weapons. Some studies have looked at people who have shot themselves but survived. And the people who have done that, when they're interviewed, they've been asked, how long before you attempted to kill yourself were you actively thinking about doing it? And over 80% of those people said it was less than 1 hour. And over 25% of those people said that it was less than 5 minutes. So suicide of that type, I mean, those kind of sudden, like jumping off a bridge, shooting oneself, those kinds of no return suicides are often very impulsive. Another example of this is in the state of Washington, there were two bridges across a river, and there were a number of suicides on each of those bridges each year. And then at one point in time, on one of the bridges was erected a suicide barrier so that people couldn't commit suicide by jumping off of that bridge anymore. And the other bridge, which was very short distance away, easily a person could walk to it, in the subsequent years, that bridge didn't show any increase in suicides. So it looked as though people who might have jumped off that first bridge but were prevented, they didn't walk 15 minutes to the other bridge and jump off. They found some other path. So there's a lot of research evidence that many suicides are extremely impulsive. Well, if you've got a passionate individual and somebody who's used to making quick decisions and they have access to a weapon, and perhaps they have the disinhibition of using drugs or alcohol, any or all of those things, you might have an impulsive act happen.
You know, one intriguing thing about the literature, it talks about how in most instances of murder-suicide, that person has no criminal background or no major brushes with the law, because I think there's a tendency to try to demonize people who do things like this and think of them as, well, they were probably criminals, but not the case, huh?
No, that's correct. When the research looks at causal factors, a prior criminal record does not turn out to be a predictive factor at all.
You know, in a situation like this, you'll hear people say, I could never imagine this person doing this. I mean, this is just so out of character. Could that really be true, or were there warning signs that might have been missed?
Well, nothing like what has happened here or generally a murder-suicide, they cannot be predicted. 99.9% of people who have all the recipe of ingredients that we've talked about will not commit a murder-suicide. So it really can't be predicted. But afterwards, family and friends and people thinking about it can often note patterns in the person's behavior that they put it together and they think, well, this does make some sense. These things that they observed afterwards or recalled afterwards wouldn't be enough to have predicted it ahead of time. But it would help maybe make some sense of it afterwards. You know, you might notice a period of time where the person was more isolated or in the relationship a history of escalating violence or threats or... But here again, in most situations, even the ones that have those elements, no one will kill themselves or someone else. So it's real. I don't think people, family members or friends, should in any way feel bad about not having been able to predict such an event, because no one could predict it. But rather, sometimes going over it afterwards helps make some sense and helps us be prompted to pay attention to each other. That's the benefit, if there is one, of something like this, that we may want to confront our friends and family more upfront when we notice changes in their behavior or signs of distress or signs of substance abuse or whatever it may be. I guess the lesson here would be not to ignore those things, to really ask the person about it, bring it to their attention.
Well, Dr. Claiborne, we want to thank you for being with us on Casey Currents.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dan Claiborne is an Overland Park forensic psychologist. He has worked with police departments and serves on the hostage negotiation team for the Olathe Police Department.
Part of Casey Currents today, you can catch individual stories or hear the whole show online at kcur.org, and we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. What makes one business weather an economic recession more gracefully than another? KSMU's Jennifer Davidson has this report on one small business in West Plains.
On East Main Street, a stone's throw away from the quaint town square, Meadowbrook Natural Foods sits sandwiched between an insurance agency and a title company. When you step inside, the aroma of spices, herbs, and vitamins hits you. This store is owned and run by Joe and Adele Voss, who met later in life as random partners at a square dancing lesson.
We've got baking items and snack items and pastas and grains and flours and cereals and nuts and dried fruits.
I have to wait a while before Adele can break away for a moment to speak to me. I ask her if her store is always this busy.
Some days it'll stay like this all day. Some days we have some quiet time. We can get some other things done, like placing orders to restock the shelves.
She says other than that first summer of the recession, the summer of 2009, when they saw a dip in sales, the store has maintained steady profits throughout the economic downturn.
No matter the economy, they're still going to want their natural supplements and their health foods.
Because people need to eat, and people that want natural stuff want natural stuff. It's that simple.
Joe Voss is co-owner of the store.
My mother used to always say that during the Great Depression, if you had a job, there was no depression.
It's true that specialty food stores, like organic food stores, have been pegged as one of the recession-proof industries. But for the most part nationwide, that's because the people buying those products had above-average incomes and weren't hurting that much from the recession. And incomes in the rural Ozarks tend to be way below average. It was time to consult the experts to explain this phenomenon. Ardeshir Dalal is the chair of the economics department at Missouri State University. He says two things to consider when pinpointing recession-proof industries are whether income is a factor and the extent to which people view those goods as being replaceable. So, a quick economics lesson. What we're looking at here is what economists call goods for which there's a relatively inelastic demand.
That is where people want to buy the commodity and will probably continue to buy those commodities even if there are fluctuations in, even if prices were to go up, they wouldn't reduce their consumption of those goods by too much.
Dalal says even though some people are very passionate about organic food, money usually takes precedence over passion when it comes to substituting products like food. So in a lower income area like South Central Missouri, he's betting that the alternative medicines and supplements have significantly helped pull this store through.
If the store were to sell only organic products, I would be quite surprised at the fact that it is so recession-proof because there are so many substitutes for organic products. But if they are selling, if they do a substantial business in alternative medicines, things like herbal medicines, homeopathic medicines, then the demand for those tends to be very inelastic.
Meadowbrook does offer a wide variety of herbal and natural health products. Adele, the co-owner, confirms that many people come here instead of going to a doctor. Another curveball in this case, though, is a clientele with very specific needs. Again, store owner Joe Voss.
We have a large number of Seventh-day Adventists who live in this area, and they tend to go toward the vegetarian approach. And so that really works well with natural food store.
Seventh-day Adventists generally follow the Old Testament's dietary guidelines. They don't eat pork or any food considered unclean. Also, many members of the Sabbath-keeping Russian community just north of West Plains, which is about 500 people strong, frequent this store often. Sue Baird, chair of the not-for-profit Missouri Organic Association, told KSMU she isn't surprised to hear of a natural food store doing so well in the recession, even though it's in an economically depressed part of the country. Her take on it is that people in this part of the Ozarks have been leaders for a long time in preserving the water supply and forestry, and that it's not a far jump from being concerned about those issues to being concerned about the purity of your food supply. For KSMU News, I'm Jennifer Davidson.
Thank you.
Coming up, Kansas City, Missouri City Hall turned 75 years old. This is Casey Current. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. In area news this week, the city council tackled problems with ambulance response times and charity marathon congestion. Kansas got final permission to privatize Medicaid, and Kansas Cityans agonized over the story of murder, suicide, and an orphan child. Steve Bell revisits those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
The tale of tragedy began with a Saturday morning 911 call from a distraught mother.
She's still breathing, but barely. Please hurry. I don't know how many times he shot her. They were arguing.
Okay, so she's been shot?
No.
Okay, right now, is she awake?
Oh, yes, stay with me. The ambulance is going away. You hear me? You hear me? The fire goes. Guys, stay with me.
The mother of Kansas City Chiefs linebacker Jovan Belcher was present when her son shot Cassandra Perkins, mother of his infant daughter. Belcher shot Perkins multiple times, then drove to Arrowhead Stadium, where he thanked General Manager Scott Pioli and Coach Romeo Crennel for all they had done for him, and in their presence took his own life. Mayor Sly James said the violence was part of a disturbing trend in urban culture.
This is part of the tragedy of urban living in this country anymore.
And wondered whether fandom's ire over losing season added to stresses that caused Belcher to crack.
What is it like to be unable to go to dinner without people getting in your face and calling you scum and loser and everything else?
The Chiefs played the Carolina Panthers as scheduled the following day and won, breaking an 8-game losing streak. The NFL and the Chiefs announced that a trust fund for the couple's daughter will hold more than $1 million. Mayor James observed that won't bring her parents back. The debates over whether to expand Medicaid and take advantage of the national health care law continued. In Missouri, expansion advocates lobbied Republican legislators who oppose it. Cynthia Keel is with the Missouri chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
Missouri medical debt is responsible for about 40% of the bankruptcies in Missouri, and I know that because I'm a banker's wife.
The Kansas Health Institute estimated that following through on the expansion would end up enrolling 100,000 more Kansans at a cost of about $500 million over the first 7 years, and that made the report's author, Scott Bruner, skeptical about whether the expansion would happen.
There's not enough revenue to cover the current level of expenditure.
Meanwhile, Kansas received approval from the federal government to proceed with privatizing its existing Medicaid programs. The Kansas City City Council expanded the advisory board for the fire department ambulance service. Councilman John Sharp explained.
It does strengthen the voice of the council, and it does provide more physician input.
The council also passed an ordinance to help avoid problems caused by charity walks and marathons. Jan Markison was a sponsor.
There was a marathon in the West Bottoms during the American Royal season. Not a good idea. We had the one that encircled the city market, and they lost 60% of their revenue on one Saturday.
Under the new arrangement, the Parks Department will take over the approval and coordination process. Flu cases began popping up in Missouri, with 2,000 cases confirmed in eastern sections of the state so far. And Dr. Christopher Harrison of Children's Mercy Hospital said the flu season is here early this year.
In years past, the kind of levels we would ordinarily see around Christmas time.
Compounding the problem of the early start, Harrison says there's a new flu strain this year, so a greater number of people don't have basic immunity to it without a flu shot. This is KCUR.
City Hall in downtown Kansas City, Missouri, turned 75 this year. This 29-story building was one of the projects of a Depression-era public works program called the 10-Year Plan.
On a recent windy day outside City Hall, historian Dr. Bill Worley told KCUR's Laura Spencer that the 10-year plan was the brainchild of political boss Tom Pendergast, city manager Henry McElroy, and then-judge Harry Truman.
In 1931, it was clear that unemployment was going to be a big problem in Kansas City, as it was across the country. And to counter that, these three men put together this idea of a 10-year plan, which was that they would borrow money that would be repaid over a 10-year period to build public buildings in Kansas City, in Independence, and pave roads and streets throughout Kansas City and Jackson County. It was approximately a $50 million bond issue, which in those days was quite a substantial sum. They put together what they called a Committee of 1,000 to assess the projects, and the civic center piece, of which the City Hall is the crowning jewel, was one of the things that everyone agreed upon. We needed to put City Hall, County Courthouse, Police Headquarters, and the Missouri Court of Appeals all in the same block of land, hopefully with harmonious architecture.
City Hall alone, it included 20,000 cubic feet of concrete. Could you talk about that connection to Tom Pendergast?
Tom Pendergast, as a political operator, understood that there were several ways to profit from that particular effort. And one of them was by having companies that would sell products to the city and county for construction. And so once he was able to get allies in the position of city manager in the form of Henry McElroy, and in the county court with Harry Truman as the presiding judge, then he organized a number of companies, probably the most prominent and well-known of which was Ready Mix Concrete.
Right now we're on the south side of the building, and there are a number of statues, including Abraham Lincoln and his son Tad, but there are also fountains with ornamental seahorses, and they were nicknamed Lug and Cut.
During the 1930s, shortly after they were placed and the building opened, city employees who understood the concept of cut and lug very well nicknamed them. The cut was that any contract that a non-Pendergast company got with Kansas City or Jackson County, the organization got a cut of 10% off the top. That was the cost of doing business with the city or the county at that time. The lug was a similar 10% that employees of the city and county had to pay out of their paycheck or have it withheld, that ultimately went to the Pendergast organization, as he called it. Other people would say the Pendergast machine. The nickname was a rather rueful one as far as city employees were concerned. They were thankful to have the jobs. On the other hand, they knew that those statues had cost them their 10%.
This wasn't the first City Hall for Kansas City, Missouri. It was the third. Why was it that at the time city officials talked about needing a new City Hall?
Well, the first City Hall was a very small building located where the City Market is today, and it was ultimately replaced then by a larger City Hall, which included a much larger area for the City Market, and the two were actually integrally connected at that time. The second City Hall had been constructed in the 1890s at about the same time that the old county courthouse had gone up. And in both cases, they were really too small as the city and county grew. To give you an example, when they were built there in Kansas City, there would have been something around 175,000 people. Well, by 1930, there were 400,000 people in Kansas City, Missouri. So the need for a new building and a larger building in both the courthouse and the city hall was apparent, and additionally with the police headquarters and such as that. So the reality is that it was a physical necessity, but also it was a put people back to work necessity, which is how it came to be a part of the 10-year plan.
One of the aspects of the city hall, it's 29 stories, but there's the 30th floor observation deck. And I know that you've been up there a number of times. I wonder if there's a favorite thing that you like to point out to people, or kind of a favorite, as a historian, what you like to see up there.
Honestly, it is a remarkable view of downtown because at this point it is one of the highest points in downtown. not the highest building, but because of its location in terms of being on something of a prominence on the east side of downtown, you really can see the whole area. It's just a remarkable view of everything that has been at the heart of Kansas City since well back into the 19th century.
Dr. Bill Worley, who's instructor of history for Metropolitan Community Colleges at Blue River in Independence, spoke with KCUR's Laura Spencer. To see photos of the building inside and out, check out our website at kcur.org. Kansas City playwright Ron Simonian had his first play produced in a warehouse in the Crossroads District, and when it moved to an off-Broadway house in New York, he assumed he had the world on a string. The Soul Collector, his seventh world premiere at the Unicorn Theater, opens this weekend. But as he tells KCUR's Steve Walker for our series Artists in Their Own Words, his career hasn't always progressed in traditional ways.
It's been 30 years since the writer Ron Simonian diverted his attention away from filmmaking to theater, when he turned a potential screenplay called Thanatos into a stage play.
We did it in a warehouse behind Manny's Mexican Restaurant in downtown Kansas City. It made me fall in love with theater, to see something come to life, as opposed to all these years of having people read your scripts, making these cuttings, and then trying to shoot scenes and not getting anything done. And it was like a real living piece of, you know, theater. And then it kind of got addicting from there.
An early fan was Cynthia Levin, artistic director of the Unicorn Theater, and Simonian was on a roll for some time. The Unicorn eventually premiered six of his plays, many featuring violent premises and flagrant profanity that, right or wrong, seemed to define him and his work.
When you were in your late 20s, early 30s, and known for writing dark characters with dark intentions, and there was lots of violence and blood, were you a dark person?
I had an agent in New York. Her name was Susan Schulman. When I met her in New York, I got off the plane. They met me at the airport, and we were talking for about 10 minutes, the first time we'd actually met. And she said, "You are so different than we thought you were going to be, because you do not fit the profile of a man who writes these types of plays." But there's a lot of writers who resemble their work. I really never did. I think that was a misconception that caused a lot of people to kind of be wary of me in life in general. There was a play I had written, Desert Holiday. That play symbolized more of who I am, this kind of sometimes lonely, in love with being in love, you know. And yet the plays that people would associate me with are two hitmen in the woods, you know, trying to bury a body.
Over the years, Simonian's work has been seen in other venues. Two of them, Bazooka's Gentleman's Club and Science City at Union Station, overlapped, which made for uncomfortable bedfellows.
Bazooka Showgirls is a gentleman's club in Kansas City, and the owner of the club is very theatrically minded, and they had said they wanted me to come in and do a one-man show at the theater. So they had me write the show in response to the vagina monologues from a male perspective. And from there, they put me on this billboard on the highway, and it was a huge billboard. And I used to be one of the lead writers at Science City. I'd take, how do you use liquid nitrogen? I'd turn it into a little theatrical piece to make it entertaining for the kids. Well, they were done with me instantly. I mean, I was fired like instantaneously.
In his latest play, The Soul Collector, Simonian plays a slick television evangelist named Lester Dupree, whose view of the world is heard here in a clip that some listeners may find objectionable.
Lester would say, "It's a well-known fact that all of the Jews, Muslims, and atheists will all go straight to hell upon Christ's return. For when the rapture starts, there is a certain group of people who are going to be very shocked at the icy cold reception they will receive when the Lord returns at all. If there was a vent on the floor right there, and that vent went straight to the bowels of hell, and smoke was rising from that straight out of hell upon the rapture, that smoke would smell an awful lot like the Pope's hat." This is not a play that attacks religion. It doesn't attack anyone's faith, but it attacks those who use that faith for evil and for cash.
Simonian admits that for all the attention his earlier violent works drew, he softened with age and, as a father, becoming more intrigued with stories about family. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
The Soul Collector by Ron Simonian runs through December 23rd at the Jerome stage of the Unicorn Theater. For more information, visit the Arts and Culture section of our website at kcur.org. The Artist in Their Own Words series is sponsored by the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. As always, we thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan and Alex Smith. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Zach Lewandowski is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. And I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.